Derek Inman, is going to tell us about precision reconstruction of the cold dark matter neutrino relative velocity.
Right. So unfortunately, JD was sick, so I am taking over. So that means you can blame any inaccuracies on JD. And anything you find particularly clever is something I added in at the last minute. OK. So right, so we'll go through some stuff. All right, so in case you haven't gotten enough background on neutrinos today, I know this is the third talk, so I'll go through this quickly. So there's a cosmic neutrino background. It's subdominant in energy density, so it's driven by the dark matter potential. And what we know is mass squared differences for neutrinos, and we have constraints on the sum of their total masses. Okay, and our goal, our primary goal, is to figure out what their actual masses are. All right, so typically when people do this, they look for the effects of neutrinos on the total matter power spectra, that sort of thing. They typically suppress the total matter power spectra. For a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, we're going to be looking at a different type of effect that's not been studied, and we've proposed it. And we talked about it a little bit further by Hongming tomorrow. But here's the general thing we're talking about. So because neutrinos are starting out hot and dark matter start out cold, a relative motion between the two species can occur. So this means there's relative bulk motion between neutrinos and dark matter. And what we have in what we sort of imagine could happen is that we have some halo and we have some neutrinos that are flowing over this halo. And what happens is they're gravitationally focused into a downstream wake, a neutrino downstream over density. So this is a dipole type distortion, and I'll clarify that a bit later. And our goal is to understand how we could use such an effect to determine neutrino masses. The crucial point about this is that, and will be a good portion of this talk, is that understand this dipole distortion, you really need to know the relative motion between the neutrinos and the dark. That is, you need to know what direction this dipole distortion is in. Okay. And so to study such things, we of course go to n-body simulations, as hopefully Haran and Neil have convinced you. And what I'll be talking about is the relative velocity reconstruction and how well we can do it. So just a summary. Simulations. This is the same type of simulations that Haran was talking about. We have QP3M. We run dark matter first, and then we add in neutrinos at a later redshift. Some of parts of the simulation will be about the Tianyu simulation that Haran was describing, and some parts will just be other ones. So in this case, we started neutrinos at the 10. And of course, to answer this question, we have linear velocities and and we discussed that in great detail in the last talk. Okay, so for the next few slides I'll be showing, the simulations we were using, we had four of them for different neutrino masses. 1,500 cubed cold dark matter and 8 times that in
so neutrinos. Yes, couldn't you just have used the linear evolution of the Boltzmann equation? Or is that something that's, I mean, it must be something available in...
To use, so I think that's what Willy was describing, was paraphrasing Yassine's paper, was doing a linear evolution of the Boltzmann equation. So we're now three levels deep. I'm describing what Layli said about what Yassine said, which is one way. So when you tell this story, you have to pass that along. It'll be four levels deep. But you can, but it doesn't quite get the neutrinos right, I believe, is the summary. But you can get the power spectra right, I think. That was the, if memory serves, that was the conclusion of the paper.
That's still better than what you're doing, isn't it? I mean, the thing is that the linear evolution of neutrinos is something that's captured in like a CMB fast, right?
Yeah. So if you just want linear evolution, then you can get that
right
by doing something like that. Maybe when I show some power spectra, we'll see why you might not be convinced, or at least you'd want to.
No, but I'm thinking that's for the initial conditions of the neutrino velocity. So here you're just using the Lovich velocity, and then at every point, Fermi-Dirac shifted.
Yeah, right. So we output from classic CAM the velocity transfer function to get the linear component, and then we just add on top a uniform Fermi-Dirac.
Yeah.
By the way, just to clarify, if even these perturbations are small and it all comes from the dark matter, and even if you don't displace them at all, take the unperturbed quantum density, everything you tweener and put it there, yeah, it's almost the same because it's all perturbed by the cold dark matter anyway. So it's whether or not you perturb them at all makes relatively little difference. Obviously, you like to get closer to the growing mode, but even if you turn it off,
yeah. Well, what we're saying is number two is by far the most important part. So we don't have. We don't have a plot showing this, but you know it's
okay.
A large difference. Ah, sure.
This might be a very naive question, but it's something that people have asked me before, and I've never had a good answer to. So using Fermi Dirac,
yes.
Neutrinos are fairy ants. How different would it be if you used Bose-Einstein? Like, what if there was a bosonic component of dark radiation?
So,
like, can we tell the difference? Because if I just do linear perturbations. Those distributions, like, you know, that doesn't care whether you're a fermion or a boson, as far as I can tell.
So let me ask
you, like, higher order.
Let me answer a very similar question. So if you replace the Fermi Dirac with the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, you can notice it. Whether you would actually notice it, I don't know. But if you just look at a power spectrum, you can tell.
And is that something special about things being nonlinear? Because
no, it's special about...
linear theory, like,
in the
perturbations,
you integrate over the velocity distribution, which depends on which background distribution you put in. Yeah.
What temperature do you have the distribution at?
The standard one, like just under 2 Kelvin.
Okay.
Whatever it is. Is that?
Yeah, that answers my question, but I need to think about it.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I can answer in more detail at some other time. Okay, so we run some simulations is the conclusion of the slide. All right, so what we can do is we can take a look at slices of our simulations. So dark matter, so standard. If we look for halos, we can see it here. And then for two different neutrino masses, you can see, of course, that the heavier ones are more clustered just because they have slower velocities. And some pretty figures. Oh. Okay, onto the power spectrum. So colors are slightly different from the one Howran showed, but this is CDM power spectra. This is blue is halos, and then red is neutrinos. Dotted here is linear. Dashed is this sort of nonlinear ratio, and solid is what we observe in simulation, which is quite different from linear theory. So that's why you might want to do these n-body simulations, okay? Right, so this is not something that's particularly new. So let's move on to the velocity fields. I think those are more interesting for the subject of this talk. So to compute velocities, we do two slightly different things. For neutrinos, what we do is we just take a sort of momentum. For neutrinos, because we have more neutrino particles than we do dark matter, and also because neutrino particles are neutrinos are much more diffusely spread out, they're less clustered. There's always a neutrino particle in a group. So this is, we're trying to make velocity fields on a grid. So there's always a neutrino particle in a grid, so we can just take the average velocity of all the neutrino particles in your grid cell, and that gives you a velocity field for neutrinos. For dark matter, it's actually much sort of more annoying to deal with because they're much more clustered, and since we have fewer dark matter particles, there will be empty grid cells. So if you try to just divide, you get something that's undefined, so you actually have to do a search for the nearest particle. So that's just a bit slower numerically to do. So that's sort of annoying, but nonetheless, we can do it. Okay, so let's take a look at some velocity field slices. If memory serves, these are this is like an XY slice with velocity coming out of the page. So BZ, in that sense. So dark matter, neutrinos, and then their relative motion. So we subtract the two. Okay, so this was all from particle-based methods. But typically when we go out and try to determine things, what we're really good at is getting density fields. And I guess we'll have some talks about velocity fields later on today, but what we have for our large scale fields are density fields. So we want to see, can we get velocities from those? So the way in which you do this is to use these linear transfer functions and apply it to the density contrast field. Okay. So we have our density contrast, and then we can multiply it, divide through by the density. So say we measure some either halo density field or dark matter density field or whatever. We can divide through by T delta and multiply by a velocity transfer function, and that gives us a velocity field. Okay. So when we do that, we get this sort of figure here. You can sort of see these halos are still sort of speckled in here, but you can also, if you spend enough time looking at this, convince yourself that they look quite similar. Of course, we want to do a bit better than that, so we can look at, we can look at the next slide, which is power spectra of the various things. So this is the relative velocity between neutrinos and dark matter with our methods. Let's see. This linear theory is dotted. The simulated one with those particle-based velocities that I just described is this black curve here. And then the red one is this reconstructed one that I just described as well.
It's Vc minus Vnu.
Yes, relative velocity. Relative velocities on this figure. And okay, so you might be saying, okay, these are wildly different. Okay, that's complete garbage, and why are you even giving this talk? But if we look at the cross-correlation coefficient between them, it's actually quite good. So it's almost always near one for a large number of scales. So what that means is effectively is we're getting the direction of the neutrinos right. And of course, if we need to get this amplitude right, we can just scale it away ourselves. Okay. So there's the cross-correlation coefficient. And I think we should have a conclusion. The direction of the relative velocity field can be reconstructed accurately using a density field is the takeaway message from this part of our simulation. And I'm not entirely sure. This is the halo reconstructed correlation coefficient. We also have a CDM. Okay. Any questions on this before I move on?
So that means accurate in direction but not in amplitude?
Well, the black curve and the red curve here differ in amplitude a fair bit, but in principle, I could just divide by this ratio, and then you'd say the magnitude is right. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So when you generate a CDM velocity field, you are averaging over n particles. So what's the number of n?
We average over one particle. We could average over n, but of course that could be slow.
Actually, so when there's in a void, there's no particle. How you go in this grid in the void?
So
biasing velocity field.
Yeah. So exactly, we have to go search out till we find the nearest particle.
So
that could be a ways away.
So you just set a velocity not centered, is not close to this, set the velocity of that platform is not around this grid. So.
Right.
So, well, the biasing vector.
There is, I could refer you to a couple of papers on using this method. I don't really, do you remember who's the author on that paper? Yeah, there's two papers on this. There's some artifact, but if you have enough particle density, it's not a big deal. But there's someone who's looked at this, yeah. I can point you to that. Okay, so let's now go back to our dipole thing, our dipole observable quantities, or just some observable quantities, one of which will be the dipole. Okay, so we recall that picture of a neutrino wake behind it. So the way in which we could go and I'm getting the spinny wheel of MacBooks, so hopefully this changes soon.
So to predict the
yes.
neutrino velocity, so it's a scheme that you take the halo density, convert that to a velocity, scale by the ratio of the neutrino to
yes.
I see. And that works well enough, you're saying, for the directions, but not the amplitude.
When you do that scaling with the ratio, that would give you the amplitude. Because that would just, in that correlation coefficient plot, now I'm on the summary. Yeah. In the correlation coefficient plot, that's an effect that would just divide out, right, because it's a ratio.
But you're using the ratio of the linear transfer functions of neutrinos to dark matter, is that right? To get the
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that gives you the direction. And then I was saying, oh, if you want, you could also, again, apply.
It's just weird that it gives you the direction correctly, but not the amplitude, right? Because you're taking this like difference of vectors and, you know.
I think that the weirdness is just that the, if you're using a linear dark matter transfer function, the dark matter is known to be a vector of 10 off from linear, that's just a fact, then dividing by the own transfer function.
Yeah, I mean,
but the velocity happens to be linear. Again, the reasons I don't think anybody has a good, I haven't had a good explanation why, but the velocities happen to be very close to linear, and the densities happen not to be. So clearly, you'll be off by that nonlinear bias.
So last.
I'm just very confused. I mean, last time
I was here, someone posed the idea that the linear scale for velocities is higher than. For density, and that's why this works so well.
But you're going from density to,
velocity.
The density you're saying is too high compared to linear.
Yeah.
So my velocity vector is just too big. Now I rescale that by these ratio of linear transfer functions. I compare now to my original vector, and this minus this is my relative velocity. But this is too big, you're saying. And somehow the direction of this minus this comes out right.
Oh, the relative velocity.
They're both too big by the same amount.
I mean, VNU and VC are
By
the same amount.
You have to use two transfer functions. It's the relative velocity between neutrinos and dark matter. So the velocity of neutrino transfer function and the velocity of dark matter transfer function.
So you're saying that the nonlinear boost to dark matter also nonlinearly boosts the neutrino velocity.
Because you use the same input field.
So even though the neutrinos are not nonlinear, you're saying, the nonlinear boost in their... I'm just very puzzled.
They're predicted. So the predicted neutrino, which is based on the galaxy density,
which is highly nonlinear, has its extra.
But the R is 0.99 something.
So I saw your number. I'm just trying to fathom how this happens.
Okay. Maybe.
Go to the next page, but I'm going to take 5 minutes to go to the next page again.
Oh.
One page. Okay, just hit it once and then we can keep talking. No, hit it again, don't hit it again.
No, I'm just moving the mouse I like to see the spinny wheel. Alright, it's now switched on the laptop, so we can expect this in like 5 more minutes.
The sense of it is that on the scale where there's the biggest difference, the dark matter is flowing in, but the neutrinos are not, right? If you have a wave, they're flowing into the peaks.
The nonlinear motions of the dark matter, right.
Forgetting even about nonlinear, just in linear, is the dark matter still moving, but the neutrinos are not, is that right?
Yes.
The transfer function is smaller for neutrinos,
right.
Sorry.
It's okay. Okay, so we're going to talk about this dipole type idea. Like I said, there'll be a bit more discussion of it in a subsequent talk, but the quantity we're computing is shown up here. So it's a correlation function, but we're looking for a dipole component. So we're looking just for a component of, so we take r hat, so the direction that you're looking for your correlation, and dot it with the relative velocity, okay? So that's the way to interpret that. So you know, if there's an excess downstream, that's what you're looking for. And the way we
What are these delta I delta j?
Density contrast. Okay, so you need two density fields. Okay, so say you add delta galaxy and delta Lenzing.
Oh, okay, I see.
So, or however you define two density fields. The way we've defined this is if you put the same one in, you get zero. Okay.
Just like imagining a power spectrum.
Yeah, the idea we're going for is that these two deltas are, they should be biased differently to neutrinos, so you get a term that's not canceling out in this. Okay. Yeah. Right. So this is the part that we were thinking about before with the wake downstream. Okay. Okay. So and we've done some very preliminary computations on this. We've looked for the VC new dipole, the cold dark, where delta I is cold dark matter, delta J is neutrinos, and then we have VC new that we use. And this gives us this red curve. So that's what we're looking for. And right now we're being confounded by subsequent issues that there's also a relative motion between halos and dark matter, which I show here, which is much larger. So we're still working on disentangling this, but that's one thing we've been looking at. Okay. Right. And more questions, I guess, for tomorrow. Okay. And now we wait patiently for the next slide.
So we're working on scales of like 1 megaparsec.
Yeah.
And in your previous like part of the cross correlation coefficient, I mean, like, you know, where was it going to zero, remember?
It turned over just past 1 megaparsec.
In K.
Yeah, in K.
And so to go from K to R, do I do 2 pi over K, or is there not a 2 pi? I always forget.
I think there's a 2 pi.
So then isn't this kind of worse?
One pi for this purpose.
1 pi, okay.
Your backup sweet, yeah. From the halo's work, the halo separation is usually bigger than a megaparsec, meaning it's hard to get the velocity field smaller than a megaparsec level.
Yes, so I was just wondering if it is sensible to, you know, to work on scales of like 1 megaparsec.
It's certainly things you have to consider. Right now, as I said, we're sort of more worried about the much bigger line. That's confounding, but if you want to do it in detail, that's something you have to.
With the neutrino dipole. But that peaked at like, you know, 10 megaparsecs or something.
Oh, let's not go back to the previous slide. This presentation will go forever if we do that. Okay. Any more questions on dipoles? Okay. So again, this is another preliminary thing. What this is looking at halo masses. As Haran described, there were two Tian simulations, one where we just ran the dark matter from 100 to 0, and one where we run the dark matter from 100 to 5, then add in neutrinos. Okay, so that gives us two simulations, and we can compare them. Okay, so what we have done, so what we want to do is look at, so just the general idea here is we want to look at corresponding halos between the two simulations. That is, typically the neutrinos aren't such a big effect that halos are just wildly different or anything. So we can actually compare halo by halo, and we want to look for differences in their mass or something like that, okay? Okay, so the way we've set this up is to look at is to divide our simulation up into 14,000 subvolumes, okay? Now, in those 14,000 subvolumes, we can rank our halos by their mass. We know how many particles are in them, okay? What we can also do is compute what their local values of their CDM density contrast and their neutrino density contrast. And for this purpose, for the neutrino density contrast, that's the neutrino transfer function over the dark matter transfer function times delta C, just so that that's somewhat of an observable quantity. Okay, and so what we show here is the 14,000 points of these values. So obviously, this is delta C, sorry, it's a bit pixelated. This is delta nu. So obviously, as delta C increases, there's a corresponding trend where delta nu increases. That makes sense. If there's more amount of matter, there's going to be more amount of neutrinos. However, what you can also see is there's a large amount of scatter around this mean trend. Okay, this means we can look for systematic effects of neutrinos, discounting the, how do I want to say this? We can look for effects of neutrinos in this sort of, there could be more or less, for a given delta C, okay? So for a very particular value of delta C, we can do this computation. Okay. All right, so what we show on the right-hand side then, so this is for the most massive halo. We look for their delta C and delta nu. All right, assuming people are still with me. On the right-hand side now, we show for the most massive halo, the second most massive, third most massive, fourth most, 1, 2, 4, 8, I mean, excuse me. What we should compute are the difference between the two, their relative difference in mass between the two simulations of the neutrino, of the halos, apologies, as a function of this delta nu scatter, so the difference away from this relative trend, this fitted line, okay? So it's the difference away. And what we see is a very small effect, but an effect that we can actually see is that you look very closely, there's this sort of fitted line through the middle, and it goes up, okay? So it's not flat. And what this means is that, and this axis is delta nu, and this is the relative difference in the halo masses. So what this means is for regions of the same delta C, if you increase delta nu or decrease delta nu, it does have an effect on halo masses. We're still investigating whether this would ever be an observable effect or how you'd go about doing something, but it's something we've noticed and are looking into. Okay.
These numbers are hard to read.
I know, I'm sorry about that.
Do you have a plot of just the top left panel? You had it on there a few minutes ago. You had just the top left panel by itself, right?
This one?
Yeah.
Just this one.
I think if you have Alt tab
on the back text now. If you create this keynote, you can find this.
All right. These are dangerous times, but we can do it. All right. There's four figures. Let's see which one comes up. Oh, here. Got it. Nope. Where is it? Ah, so that?
Can you full screen?
Yeah, I got it. Where's my mouse? Yes. There it is. I got it. There we go. Okay, bigger plot. Hopefully you can all see the... You still can't see these axes. That's just problematic, isn't it? I'm sorry about that. I can read it off if you need.
But from here, these numbers should, in principle, tell us what is the halo bias from neutrinos, right?
It is the one that you call the two things that depend on delta nu and on delta c, and that's the ratio. And that's this is separating out the delta b nu, controlling for bc. So you're keeping all the points, you're keeping some value of bc and then trying to finish up b nu, which is this guy. So if you call this that's the b nu, I think that's the thing that you call.
Sorry, what was B? Sorry.
This B is what you call B nu.
The bias.
Oh, that depends only on the neutrinos, but not on the CDM.
Right. Okay, yeah.
Because we try to subtract off that line.
Right, because otherwise you're trying to measure the dependence on two things that are correlated to each other.
Right,
you've got to collect from one to get the other one.
Yeah, that's right. So holding fixed the dark matter.
Yeah, exactly.
This should tell you something like what is the neutrino.
This B nu, yeah, that's it. It's 0.011.
Oh. Okay, it is on there. Okay, great.
Sorry, it's hard to read.
Okay.
So B nu is 0.011 according to this measure. It's actually not quite fair because I think you should really multiply it because this is the effect on the total mass, whereas presumably when you write B nu, presumably you had in mind multiplying by omega nu over omega c. So any object presumably depends on B nu, delta nu, times omega nu over omega c.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you
multiply, it's already has the omega ratio in there, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you actually, if you multiply, that's more like one, right? So ratio is about 100.
Right.
So if we're going to multiply this by omega c of omega nu, it's all something of order like one.
No, so you're saying the halo's response to neutrino fluctuations is similar to dark matter, similar to the response to dark matter fluctuations, but only do you have so few neutrinos.
So little mass in
neutrinos.
So that's weird, though, isn't it? I mean, because the neutrinos don't cluster as strongly in the halos as the dark matter does.
That's true.
What's
confusing? I'm confused.
No, but neutrinos do for all these things make sense only if you look at kind of low k, right?
Sure. No. I mean, in the halo, right? I mean, so the overdensity of dark matter in the halo is like hundreds or thousands or whatever. And for neutrinos, it's like one or two or something, right?
Depending
on your mass.
Yeah.
So the response of a halo to a long wavelength perturbation from neutrinos is less than the response to a long wavelength perturbation from dark matter.
By at least the ratio of omega nu omega c.
No, beyond that ratio.
Beyond that ratio.
Right? The ratio is that, with that ratio you're mentioning, the ratio of the omegas,
yes,
multiplied by the multiplied by the ratio of the deltas in the halo. And so in the dark matter delta is like hundreds or thousands.
Well, but that's a self.
No, but
that's
the
self
dark matter K, this is the density and smooth density, right? If you filter below K, then the deltas are the same. The deltas in dark matter neutrinos are the same order. Forget about it. Inside the halo, the unsmoothed delta of dark matter is much higher than smoothed delta of neutrinos. I agree. But if you took delta k at 0.1 versus delta k at 0.1 for the two species, they'll be of the same order of magnitude, right? And
So what I'm saying is that the response of the halo mass to adding a long wavelength mode, right? That's the quantity affecting the bias, right? So if
you're looking at the response of the number of density of halos, not the halo mass.
And the response of the number depends upon the response of the mass multiplied by the derivative of the mass function. Right?
Okay.
So what matters is the response of the halo mass to a long wavelength mode. I'm saying that for neutrinos, that response is down by a factor of like 100.
So. No, I don't think that's what this is measuring.
Okay.
So the thing that's large, like 100, is the halo's effect on itself. That's the delta of 200. This is measuring this delta C, you see all the other halos nearby, so that fluctuation is still small. So if I say, you know, so the actual total, so if you average it over some large volume, let's say 10 megaparsecs, then the fluctuations in delta C and delta mu, that's what the other thing is also saying, those fluctuations are not that different. It's only like in the center of megaparsec, sure, the fluctuations are huge. But as you change the omega on 10 megaparsecs by, say, 10%, that mass will also change by only order 10%, not by order 100, not by order 10,000%.
I suggest we let Derek finish his talk, and then we'll continue this discussion over coffee.
Well, I only have a summary slide left. So.
Okay. Well, then we'll get an early coffee break with Derek.
Maybe rather than trying to get it back on, which might take 10 minutes, I'll just I'll give the summary so you can accurately get the relative velocity just from measuring a density contrast. You can use dipole correlation functions, and that might tell you about neutrino masses. And we've also been doing this halo mass stuff that we've been discussing vigorously.
OK, any further questions not from Whaley or Neil? OK, if not, then let's thank Derek.